Chapter 33. I up the long hill from the station at St. Cloud, Lizzie West climbed in the cold spring sunshine. As she breasted the incline, she noticed the first waves of wisteria over courtyard railings, and the highlights of new foliage against the walls of ivy-matted gardens. And she thought again, as S.E. had thought 100 times before, that S.E. had never seen so beautiful a spring. She was on her way to the Deering's house, in a street near the hilltop, and every step was dear and familiar to her. She went there 5 times a week, to teach little Juliet Deering, the daughter of Mr. Vincent Deering, the distinguished American artist. Juliet had been her pupil for 2 years, and day after day, during that time, Lizzie West had mounted the hill in all weathers. Sometimes with her umbrella bent against a driving rain, sometimes with her frail cotton parasol unfurled beneath a fiery sun, sometimes with the snow soaking through her patched boots, or a bitter wind piercing her thin jacket, sometimes with the dust whirling about her, and bleaching the flowers of the poor little hat that had to carry her through till next summer. At first the ascent had seemed tedious enough, as dull as the trudge to her other lessons. Lizzie was not a heaven-sent teacher, as he had no born zeal for her calling, and though she dealt kindly and dutifully with her pupils, she did not fly to them on winged feet. But one day something had happened to change the face of life, and since then the climb to the Deering house had seemed like a dream flight up a heavenly stairway. Her heart beat faster as she remembered it, no longer in a tumult of fright and self-reproach, but softly, peacefully, as if brooding over a possession that none could take from her. It was on a day of the previous October that S.E. had stopped, after Juliet's lesson, to ask if she might speak to Juliet's papa. One had always to apply to Mr. Deering if there was anything to be said about the lessons. Mrs. Deering lay on her lounge upstairs, reading greasy relays of dog-eared novels, the choice of which she left to the cook and the nurse, who were always fetching them for her from the cabinet to lecture, and it was understood in the house that she was not to be othered about Juliet. Mr. Deering's interest in his daughter was fitful rather than consecutive, but at least he was approachable, and listened sympathetically, if a little absently, stroking his long, fair mustache, while Lizzie stated her difficulty or put in her plea for maps or copy books. Yes, of course, whatever you think right, he would always assent, sometimes drawing a 5-franc piece from his pocket, and laying it carelessly on the table, or oftener saying, with his charming smile, colon, get what you please, and just put it on your account, you know. But this time Lizzie had not come to ask for maps or copy books, or even to hint, in crimson misery, as once. Poor soul, as he had to do, that Mr. Deering had overlooked her last little account, had probably not noticed that as he had left it, some 2 months earlier, on a corner of his littered writing table. That hour had been bad enough, though he had done his best to make it easy to carry it off gallantly and gaily, but this was infinitely worse. For as he had come to complain of her pupil, to say that, much as she loved little Juliet, it was useless, unless Mr. Deering could owe something, to go on with the lessons. It wouldn't be honest, I should be robbing you. I'm not sure that I haven't already, she half laughed, through mounting tears, as she put her case. Little Juliet would not work, would not obey. Her poor, little, drifting existence floated aimlessly between the kitchen and the lingerie, and all the groping tendrils of her curiosity were fastened about the doings of the backstairs. It was the same kind of curiosity that Mrs. Deering, overhead in her drug-scented room, lavished on her dog-eared novels and on society notes of the morning paper. But since Juliet's horizon was not yet wide enough to embrace these loftier objects, her interest was centered in the anecdotes that Celeste and Suzanne brought back from the market and the library. That these were not always of an edifying nature the child's artless prattle too often betrayed, but unhappily they occupied her fancy to the complete exclusion of such nourishing items as dates and dynasties, and the sources of the principal European rivers. At length the crisis became so acute that poor Lizzie felt herself bound to resign her charge or ask Mr. Deering's intervention, and for Juliet's sake she chose the harder alternative. It was hard to speak to him not only because one hated still more to ascribe it to such vulgar causes, but because he blushed to bring them to the notice of a spirit engaged with higher things. Mr. Deering was very busy at that moment. He had a new picture in, and Lizzie entered the studio with the flutter of one profanely intruding on some sacred rite. She almost heard the rustle of retreating wings as she approached. And then, how differently it had all turned out. Perhaps it wouldn't have, if he hadn't been such a goose, she who so seldom cried, so prided herself on a stoic control of her little twittering cageful of feelings. But if he had cried, it was because he had looked at her so kindly, so softly, and because he had nevertheless felt him so pained and shamed by what she said. The pain, of course, lay for both in the implication behind her words, in the one word they left unspoken. If little Juliet was as she was, it was because of the mother upstairs, the mother who had given her child her futile impulses, and grudged her the care that might have guided them. The wretched case so obviously revolved in its own vicious circle that, when Mr. Deering had murmured, "Of course if my wife were not an invalid," they both turned with a simultaneous spring to the flagrant ad example of Celeste and Suzanne, fastening on that with a mutual insistence that ended in his crying out, "All the more, then, how can you leave her to them?" "But if I do her no good?" Lizzie wailed. And it was then that, when he took her hand, and assured her gently, "But you do," it was then that, in the traditional phrase, she broke down, and her conventional protest quivered off into tears. "You do me good, at any rate you make the house seem less like a desert," she heard him say, and the next moment she felt herself drawn to him, and they kissed each other through her weeping. They kissed each other, there was the new fact. One does not, if one is a poor little teacher living in me. Clopin's pension suscet passy, and if one has pretty brown hair, and eyes that reach out trustfully to other eyes, one does not, under these common but defenseless conditions, arrive at the age of 25 without being now and then kissed, waylaid once by a noisy student between two doors, surprised once by one's gray-bearded professor as one bent over the hymn he was correcting. But these episodes, if they tarnish the surface, do not reach the heart. It is not the kiss endured, but the kiss returned, that lives. And Lizzie West's first kiss was for Vincent Deering. As she drew back from it, something new awoke in her, something deeper than the fright and the shame, and the penitent thought of Mrs. Deering. A sleeping germ of life thrilled and unfolded, and started out blindly to seek the sun. She might have felt differently, perhaps. The shame and penitence might have prevailed, had she not known him so kind and tender, and guessed him so baffled, poor, and disappointed. She knew the failure of his married life, and she divined a corresponding failure in his artistic career. Lizzie, who had made her own faltering snatch at the same laurels, brought her thwarted proficiency to bear on the question of his pictures, which she judged to be extremely brilliant, but suspected of having somehow failed to affirm their merit publicly. She understood that he had tasted an earlier moment of success. A mention, a medal, something official and tangible. Then the tide of publicity had somehow set the other way, and left him stranded in a noble isolation. It was extraordinary and unbelievable that anyone so naturally eminent and exceptional should have been subject to the same vulgar necessities that governed her own life, should have known poverty and obscurity and indifference. But she gathered that this had been the case, and felt that it formed the miraculous link between them. For through what medium less revealing than that of shared misfortune would he ever have perceived so inconspicuous an object as herself? And she recalled now how gently his eyes had rested on her from the first, the gray eyes that might have seemed mocking if they had not been so gentle. She remembered how he had met her the first day, when Mrs. Deering's inevitable EDAC he had prevented her from receiving the new teacher, and how his few questions had at once revealed his interest in the little stranded compatriot, doomed to earn a precarious living so far from her native shore. Sweet as the moment of unburdening had been, she wondered afterward what had determined it. How she, so shy and sequestered, had found herself letting slip her whole poverty-stricken story, even to the avowal of the ineffectual artistic tendencies that had drawn her to Paris, and had then left her there to the dry task of tuition. She wondered at first, but she understood now. She understood everything, after he had kissed her. It was simply because he was as kind as he was great. She thought of this now as she mounted the hill in the spring sunshine, and she thought of all that had happened since. The intervening months, as she looked back at them, were merged in a vast golden haze, through which here and there rose the outline of a shining island. The haze was the general enveloping sense of his love, and the shining islands were the days they had spent together. They had never kissed again under his own roof. Lizzie's professional honor had a keen edge, but as he had been spared the vulgar necessity of making him feel it. It was of the sense of her fatality that he always understood when his failing to do so might have imperiled his hold on her. But her Thursdays and Sundays were free, and it soon became a habit to give them to him. She knew, for her peace of mind, only too much about pictures, and galleries and churches had been the one bright outlet from the grayness of her personal atmosphere. For poetry too, and the other imaginative forms of literature, as he had always felt more than as he had hitherto had occasion to betray, and now all these folded sympathies shot out their tendrils to the light. Mr. Deering knew how to express with unmatched clearness and competence the thoughts that trembled in her mind. To talk with him was to soar up into the azure on the outspread wings of his intelligence, and look down dizzily yet distinctly on all the wonders and glories of the world. She was a little ashamed, sometimes, to find how few definite impressions she brought back from these flights. But that was doubtless because her heart beat so fast when he was near, and his smile made his words like a long quiver of light. Afterward, in quieter hours, fragments of Therdic emerged in her memory with wondrous precision, every syllable as minutely chiseled as some of the delicate objects in crystal or ivory that he pointed out in the museums they frequented. It was always a puzzle to Lizzie that some of their hours should be so blurred, and others so vivid. On the morning in question she was reliving all these memories with unusual distinctness, for it was a fortnight since he had seen her friend. Mrs. Deering, some 6 weeks previously, had gone to visit a relation at St. Raphael, and, after he had been a month absent, her husband and the little girl had joined her. Lizzie say due to Deering had been made on a rainy afternoon in the damp corridors of the aquarium at the Trocadero. She could not receive him at her own pension. That a teacher should be visited by the father of a pupil, especially when that father was still, as Madame Clopin said, Sibin, was against that lady's austere Helvetian code. From Deering's first tentative hint of another solution Lizzie had recoiled in a wild unreasoned flurry of all her scruples. He took her oh, no, no. As he took all her twists and turns of conscience, with eyes half tender and half mocking, and an instant acquiescence which was the finest homage to the Addie she felt he divined and honored in her. So they continued to meet in museums and galleries, or to extend, on fine days, their explorations to the suburbs, where now and then, in the solitude of grove or garden, the kiss renewed itself, fleeting, isolated, or prolonged in a shy, silent pressure of the hand. But on the day of his leave-taking the rain kept them under cover, and as they threaded the subterranean windings of the aquarium, and Lizzie looked unseeingly at the monstrous faces glaring at her through walls of glass, she felt like a poor drowned wretch at the bottom of the sea, with all her glancing, sunlit memories rolling over her like the waves of its surface. "You'll never see him again, never see him again," the Waves boomed in her ears through his last words. and when as he had said goodbye to him at the corner, and had scrambled, wet and shivering, into the passy omnibus, its great, grinding wheels took up the derisive burden, ever see him, never see him again. All that was only 2 weeks ago, and here she was, as happy as a lark, mounting the hill to his door in the spring sunshine. So Yakahart did not deserve such a radiant fate, and Lizzie said to herself that she would never again distrust her star. 2. The cracked bell tinkled sweetly through her heart as she stood listening for the scamper of Juliet's feet. Juliet, anticipating flaggered Suzanne, almost always opened the door for her governess, not from any unnatural zeal to hasten the hour of her studies, but from the irrepressible desire to see what was going on in the street. But on this occasion Lizzie listened vainly for a step, and at length, gave the bell another twitch. Doubtless some unusually absorbing incident had detained the child below stairs, thus only could her absence be explained. A third ring produced no response, and Lizzie, full of dawning fears, drew back to look up at the shabby, blistered house. She saw that the studio shutters stood wide, and then noticed, without surprise, that Mrs. Deering's were still unopened. No doubt Mrs. Deering was resting after the fatigue of the journey. Instinctively Lizzie's eyes turned again to the studio, and as she looked, she saw Deering at the window. He caught sight of her, and an instant later came to the door. He looked paler than usual, and she noticed that he wore a black coat. I rang and rang, where is Juliet? He looked at her gravely, almost solemnly. Then, without answering, he led her down the passage to the studio, and closed the door, when as he had entered. My wife is dead, she died suddenly 10 days ago. Didn't you see it in the papers? Lizzie, with a little cry, sank down on the rickety divan. She seldom saw a newspaper, since she could not afford one for her own perusal, and those supplied to the pension clopin were usually in the hands of its more privileged lodgers till long after the hour when she set out on her morning round. No, I didn't see it, she stammered. Deering was silent. He stood a little way off, twisting an unlit cigarette in his hand, and looking down at her with a gaze that was both hesitating and constrained. She, too, felt the constraint of the situation, the impossibility of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.